The following program brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities. The opinions expressed by the members of CFCI and their guests should not be construed as specific investment, legal, or tax advice. All economic and performance information is historical and not indicative of future results. Investing may involve the risk of loss of principal, and any tax advice on the show is not intended to be used by any persons for the purpose of avoiding U.S. federal or state tax. Penalties that may be imposed on such persons and each listener should seek advice from their tax advisor or legal counsel on topics that arise from the show. The representatives of CFCI and their guests are not providing legal or tax advice, and nothing should be construed as a solicitation to offer or buy securities. Now enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, welcome to the big show, Your Money with David Hayes. Thanks for hanging out with me. You know, we had a great 4th of July. I hope everyone had a great 4th of July. Monday was the best day by far, which is the day that I had my big blowout that I have every year. So thank you once again to Cody Eichert and the Sidewinders. Great music, as always, great country music. Thank you to Uno Mas, one of the greatest food trucks around. And thank you to the people that delivered our portalettes. Thank you to the people that brought our stage. Thank you, thank you, thank you. So thank yous all around. I know everyone had a great time seeing the luminaries take off, and we had the fireworks that are let off. Takes about 3.5 hours to set them up and about 15 minutes to blow them up. So that was the way we did it on Monday night. Had a great time and was in bed. But, you know, the beginning of 4th of July weekend was rotten, right? The weather was terrible. Power outages everywhere. Out at Lake Lemon, the porthole was out until Sunday, I think around, I don't know, sometime Sunday. They got opened back up with a little limited menu. But they're fully functioning again. They're back at it. I think even pizza will be back on the menu for this weekend. But that's a pretty big disruptor. And I know people out at Lake Lemon, including our house out there, we were out for, like, I don't know, like a long time, three days. And thankfully, we had a generator. So I'm going to give the shout-out right now to Unrivaled Electric, because we were storing goods for neighbors in our freezer and everything else. And, yeah, and now my buddy Tim's going to head out and service that here in the next few days, because when it runs for three straight days, that's a lot of stress on the generator. But, yeah, Unrivaled Electric, they want to be your full-service electrical contractor. They specialize in Generac generators and solar arrays. He's a veteran. And he wants to be your electrician like he is mine. Give him a call, 812-361-3604. Find him on Facebook as well. I actually texted him and said, hey, if I were you, I would fire every house around Lake Lemon right now. And they will all, I'm sure, think about getting a generator after what we've been through out here. And he said, I am so busy servicing generators that he did not put in. That did not work, that he didn't even have time at that moment to sell another generator. But he'll get his feet back underneath him probably this week, and he'll be ready to visit with you and do that. Also, Kenny Bland Auctions, they're your full-service auction service. They can offer the pre-planning, the sale of your estate or real estate. Visit my friend at KennyBlandAuctions.com. And finally, the Like Law Group. Give yourself and your family the peace of mind that comes with proper estate planning. Call Lance at the Like Law Group, 812-323-8300. All right, what did happen last week? Well, stocks posted gains last week to close out a pretty stellar month, aided by some pretty positive economic data reports, and that all major banks had passed the stress test. So that was a big, big thing. Well, let's see. Why did it go up? Well, the powered early week gains, new home sales, durable good orders, a rise in consumer confidence, that proved to be pretty influential as well. And more on Thursday reports, we had a drop in initial jobless claims and an upward revision in first quarter GDP, which helped basically say, you know what, recession is probably not right around the corner. And the results of the Fed annual bank stress test, which all major banks passed, further gave everyone some excitement. So stocks prices rallied on Friday following that encouraging inflation report, capping the end to a solid week, month, and really first half of the year. So just a lot of stuff going on. And then here we are on a Thursday as this week unfolded. And good news is bad news, right? So when you have, even though inflation dropped some last week, that was helpful, but when you still have decent jobless claims and you have good employment numbers, you have purchasing managers index, all the stuff that, you know, is like, and then the Fed talks and they say, no, we're likely to raise rates again, maybe even consecutive meetings. He reiterated that last week, that more rate hikes were coming, and because of this robust labor market. So anyway, when we get to the break here, I'm going to come back and talk about when everyone says something's going to happen, it rarely does. I'll take a quick break. Come back. It's Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. It's Your Money with David Hayes. Hope you had a great 4th of July. I'm going to be out next week, so we will be replaying a show because Doug Hughes is also out. He's going to Wimbledon. He's actually over in London, which is pretty cool. Kind of a bucket list thing for him. So next week we are going to be replaying a show. I have not yet decided which one to replay. I don't like to replay this show. I'd rather replay an Ed Slott show, a Mary Beth Franklin show, a Tom Hegna show, a Jeffrey Levine show, something like that, where these national recognized guests are on. So we'll figure that out sometime between now and then. I'll be leaving Friday evening. I'll be out all next week, actually going to Argentina, believe it or not. So I'll be gone with a couple of other guys on somewhat of an excursion of sorts. I'm not a big hunter. You guys know I love to fish. Not a big hunter, but this is actually a bird hunting trip. When I tell people we're hunting dove and duck and something else, they're like, can't you do that here? And the answer is yes, but not like that. So this is something that we bought as an auction item through Ducks Unlimited a few years ago and just couldn't make it happen. So we're finally making it happen. And so we're going to be down in Argentina, and there it's like late fall weather. So it's just kind of the opposite of where we are here for the most part. So right now, that's what I'll be doing. And then I'll be back the following week to make sure I'm here live in the studio again. All right, so remember when the Fed started tightening back in 2022, raising interest rates, stopped buying bonds, letting them roll off the balance sheet, all of that stuff. They were saying, okay, we will be in a recession by the fourth quarter of 2023. That was pretty much in the written in stone. And then everyone said, okay, this is what's going to happen, and then they're going to have to lower rates at the end of 2023. And you heard it here on the show. I'm like, no, I doubt. I really don't think that's going to happen based on everything we're seeing and the fact that everyone says it's going to happen. In my almost 30 years in practice, when everyone says something's going to happen, it rarely does. Recessions, transitory inflation, you name it. When everyone's on the bandwagon, it rarely, rarely happens. And I think some of what we're doing is choosing not to participate in the gloom and doom. I remember during previous recessions, when things start to recede and everyone starts to get nervous, then what do? They stop spending. Well, that's not happening. People are spending money, and it's evident from car sales to furniture to you name it. People are spending money. Now, our credit card balance is going up, yeah, but you can choose to participate or not participate in gloom and doom. It's really the mindset and the feelings of people that move the needle economically. I remember saying this during 2020 and 2021, you know, you can participate in this and let it get you all worked up and down, or you can just say, I'm not going to mentally participate. I've always been a half glass full guy. Actually, I would say run over the rim kind of a optimistic guy. And I just, you know, I have a mindset that I can flip things on and off, and it doesn't really bother me. Someone was saying to me the other day, how do you do all this stuff that you're doing? I'm like, well, I don't know. I mean, I've got a really great family life. I've got great friends. I have a great office. I have a great career. I get to do this every week with you guys, do other things as well, from being on boards or coaching, you know, football or whatever it might be. And I'm like, you know, I don't really know. I know I have this ability to flip the switch on and off. I don't get all worked up about things. Not everyone's like that. And it's either a gift or a curse. I can't tell you which one it is. But when you are of the mindset that you're not going to participate in this, and I want to buy that new car, or I want to do this, or I want to do that, because 70% of GDP is based on consumer spending, so what the consumer does matters. People still have jobs. They're still getting raises. They're not worried about losing their job for the most part. They'll keep doing what they want to do. And what is the Fed even doing? They're raising rates for the overnight borrowing between banks. It really only affects those that are highly in debt or are currently borrowing. There's a lot of cash out there. I mean, I see it. A lot of cash. A lot of big bank accounts that people just are sitting on. I just bought a truck. We've needed a truck. So my son uses it for things. We use it for things. It sure came in handy during the fireworks, getting rid of it after the event was over. It was a 2019. Bought it from the Bland's down the road. And I paid cash. I didn't even think about asking about financing. A couple of years ago, we bought a Jeep, and it was so cheap to borrow, I borrowed it because I felt like I could do something better with my money than, you know, paying cash for a depreciating Jeep. Now, if you look at the Wall Street Journal today on Thursday, it says U.S. auto sales defy gloomy forecasts. New vehicle sales rose an estimated 13% during the first half of the year, a pace far ahead of any industry forecast, as car buyers shake off concerns about rising rates and inflationary pressure. The supply chain pressures have eased somewhat. Automakers are more confidently churning out vehicles. Buyers are responding, and sales are bouncing back faster than anyone expected. Consumer confidence is still there, says in the article, mostly because there has been this backlog of supply for so long, and the strength in supply reflects this resilient consumer demand elsewhere, like I mentioned, to furniture, groceries, travel. U.S. consumers are continuing to spend, even though predictions are saying that economic conditions are worsening, and that's the way it goes. There's a lot of cash boomers out, a lot of cash buyers. Boomers, Gen Xers like me, we have the millennial boom on our hands right now, similar to the 90s. I've talked about this several times, where they are getting married. They are having children. They are buying houses. They are doing what the boomers did, albeit a little bit later than they did. They're not having their first kid necessarily at 27, the second one at 29, like the boomers did. Maybe it's pushed back a little bit. Like we had Will at 30, right? So we've tried again at around 32, 33. You're seeing more of that. They're doing the same thing. And when that necessity spending gets kicked into the market, it drives economic growth. So I think it's great. I think it's fantastic when you have inflation at 4% or less and you've had positive revised up GDP numbers for the first quarter. I think we'll see second quarter GDP be pretty solid. So they're raising rates. Now, I am borrowing currently right now on two pieces of real estate. I'm actually talking with them later because the rates are crazy high. And that is good, actually, because that slows things down. And that's what we need to have happen, slow things down. Now, I'm not real thrilled about borrowing on a piece of commercial real estate at 7.5% or 8%, but we've already agreed to do it, and now we're knee-deep into it, and rates are moving up quickly on us, and that's just the way it goes. You have to suck it up and buttercup and do it. But we're not actively seeking additional real estate that we have to borrow at 8% on. We're just not doing it. Now, this is investment real estate. If you are getting a mortgage for your home, personal home, yeah, you're probably still around 7%. And that's just the way it is. And that's if you're a good borrower. If your credit score is down in the 580 range, you're probably going to have to pay more. That's the way the world should work, right? The more risky the loan, the higher the rate. If you have been disciplined and diligent about doing things the right way and you have a credit score that's in that 750, 800 range or whatever, then you're going to get the better deal. It's just the way things go, and it's the way things should go. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to try to get Hot Rod on the phone, because do people with money invest differently than those that don't have a lot? The answer is yes, but we'll come back and tell you more. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Everyone, Sure Money with David Hayes. Got Rod on the phone, and Rod, I kind of teed this segment up by saying, do people with money invest differently than people that don't have a lot? And I'm like, they do. I think you intuitively know that people with money invest differently than those that don't have a lot. I think it just makes it, I mean, it makes common sense to think that, or they think they should be doing something different. Think about where you started off. Most people would say, zero. I had zero when I started saving and investing. Well, then you started saving. What were you buying? You're buying mutual funds like everyone else. likely through your retirement plan at work. You got married, you had a couple kids, trying to make ends meet, still saving, but not really thinking about it too much. And then one day you wake up like Rod and I, and you look in the mirror and you're like 50, 51, 55, and hopefully you say, we need to figure this thing out. So you meet with someone like me, or maybe not, and you say, okay, now I know what I need to do to plan for retirement. You pay down your debts, you get your house paid off, maybe sell the house and get something smaller, and then save like crazy. Then all of a sudden, with a blink of an eye, you're in your 60s, and you have something, maybe $1 million, two or three, who knows what. But how are you still investing? You're still investing the same way you did in your 20s and 30s, the same old mutual funds, the same way you did when you were poor. So how do people with money invest? Well, number one, Rod, I want to have you pick up on this. They never let an asset sit idle. They're always trying to figure out a way for their money to make more money. They own things that they have more control over. They have better risk management. There's a plethora of things. And then later I want to talk about, what does having money really even mean? Is it having $1 million or $3 million or 5 or 10 or 25 or 100 million or a billion? What is a lot of money? That's all relative, but I'm not going to go down that road quite yet. So, Rod, people with money, they just do things different.
Yeah, they most certainly do. Not only just purely from an investment perspective, but even just how they manage their finances. Many of them will spend every single penny of their expenses, be it utilities, whatever it is, all on credit cards with a cashback rewards program, and then pay it off in full at the end of the month. So they're not incurring the high interest rate of the credit card, but they are receiving the cash back off of those. So it's many different aspects of it. Now, obviously, part of the reason they invest differently, part of that is due to their wealth. The example I just gave you of the credit card, if you struggle paycheck to paycheck, it would be hard for you to implement that system and not potentially have something happen one month and then that credit card snowball into something that you couldn't handle any longer. And it's the same on the investing side. Some of the products and things that are available to that high net worth person are considered private placements. So there are some restrictions as to income levels, liquid net worth, those types of things that you have to meet and qualify. And then one of the other big ones that we talk a lot about that we're huge fans of, say a covered call strategy. Well, to sell a call against a stock position, you have to have 100 shares of that position. And when you look at stocks, and a lot of stocks trading in the $100, $200, $300, $600 range per share, well, guess what? It takes a lot of money to have 100 shares of that particular stock and own enough stock to be properly diversified to implement that type of a strategy. And then on the private side, we talked about the private placement, and there's any number of different avenues via that private world. You and I talked a little bit this morning, a new hot item that the financial institutions are trying to package up and create a retail opportunity for people out there. Private loans. It's an area to get a little more income than maybe what the bond market is paying right now. Once again, you have to qualify to get involved in those things. But I do like the fact that I am seeing our industry acknowledging that there are certain opportunities that are available to the high net worth person that aren't available to the everyday retail investor. And they're trying to create a product that they can bring that down to their level. But I think the most important thing, Dave, is what you hit on. They don't let assets sit idle that can produce additional income. So it's not enough to own a dividend-paying stock and capture the dividend and appreciation. If I can sell a call against it and collect some call premium on top of the dividend, on top of the appreciation, that's the route that they're going to go. The other thing is I think that the high-net-worth person, you know, a lot of people don't like to get called out of a stock they like. The high net worth person, he doesn't mind getting called out of a stock that he liked, because guess what? He got called out 10, 15, 20% higher than where the stock was trading when he sold that. And if he still likes that stock, he doesn't care to go back in and buy it again. But I think the people without as much wealth, they're so concerned and feel that they can't make a mistake. And actually part of it is because maybe they didn't start saving early enough.
Right.
They attempt to use returns and aggressive investment strategies to make up for lost time in beginning that program much sooner.
So there was actually an article in the Wall Street Journal today that said older Americans are investing like 30-year-olds. And that's what prompted this thought. Older Americans keep rolling the dice in the stock market, ignoring the conventional wisdom to protect their nest egg by shifting more of their investments to bonds. Nearly half of these major providers of 401k plans, they said that are 55 and older hold more than 70% of their portfolio in stock. That's up from 38% in 2011. And even older people, 65 to 69, hold two-thirds of their money in stock portfolio. People 85 or older, nearly all their money's in stock, up from 16% in 2012. The same is true for almost a quarter of the people ages 75 to 84. So basically, the article talks about what you just said, that many people invested in stocks because bonds, you know, they stunk. They were paying nothing. But now they're paying something. But people are still sticking with the same stuff. And the other thing it mentions is the fact that so many people mainly invest just in mutual funds. Let me go back to the private thing real quick. I saw a statistic, I think it was a few years ago, from Franklin Square or something, that said that 85% of companies in America with over $20 or $100 million in sales, I can't remember, are private companies. So basically, we're all peddling around with the 15% of the companies that are publicly traded, whether it's bonds, whether it's stocks, whether it's whatever. So it's kind of interesting because those people borrow too. And where do they borrow from? Well, they go to banks. Well, just like I said in the first couple segments, who wants to pay 8% for their money or 9% for their money when they could potentially, you know, have a private lender come in, secure maybe some assets that a bank wouldn't necessarily want to secure, and you're dealing with an individual, not an institution. Now, I know it's been around for a long time, but it is starting to become more prevalent than it has been in the past. So, Rod, I'm going to take a break because when I come back, I do want to dig into this a little bit deeper with you, and let me just check my outline here, and dig into some of this stuff. Like, number one, what is having a lot of money? That's important to know. You know, some people will say, oh, I didn't know I had more. I mean, people always want me, you know, it's funny, and you know this probably as well as anyone. It's funny, people want to know where they stand in relative terms to other people like them. So it's not uncommon for someone to say, so is this good? Like, is this a good point for us to be? You know, maybe they're 60 years old and they've got $2 million and they kind of want to know what other people 60 years old, what they have. So we're going to talk about what real wealth really means and when it kind of makes sense for you to start trickling out into that new world of, like Rob mentioned, some of the advanced strategies that are being used by rich people. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep going on that conversation. It's Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Got Alex Lester in here on the board, doing a great job. Alex Bailey's normally the one. All I have to do is remember there's an Alex involved, and we're going to be taken good care of. So, of course, after the show tonight on Thursday night, it will be up online at WGCLradio.com. Of course, you can always hear it on Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock. And as soon as it goes live on the World Wide Web, then it will be up on the iTunes and all the other places you get your podcast, Spotify, wherever it might be. So I've got Rod Holloway, the managing director over at CFCI, our shop, our ranch, and he is always a great contributor to the show. Also, you can hear him on Mondays and Fridays on Glass in the Afternoon, and I believe Glass is back in business today on this Thursday, and you'll be able to call in tomorrow on Friday. So here's the thing that I wanted to talk about first. What is wealth? Like, where, at what point should you say to yourself, okay, I actually have enough to do something with? Well, there's all kinds of different levels of wealth. And I guess I'm talking to you today more about the blue-collar type of millionaires, those who grew up average or maybe a little poor, and they save their way to having money. Now, because you really can't save your way to wealth. Now, I'm talking about you can save your way to $1 million, $2 million, or $3 million. It's less common for people to have $5 or $10, especially in this community. But in all those cases, you can save your way to those numbers and be kind of fortunate with your investment plan. But to have $25 million, $100 million, or $1 billion, you have to have created something. Built a business, inherited private family money. They might even have a private family office that handles all their stuff from insurance, investments, everything. But most folks with that type of money, they don't go crazy in the market. They don't have to. They'll actually go out and put a ton of their money in tax-exempt bonds, and the money that gets spit off is used to, you know, spread amongst the family. And then they might take a little bit of money, like maybe 5% or 10%, and leverage that into options where, you know, you have exposure to the market, but you have limited risk in the market. Those are the creative things that people with a lot of money do. You don't have to have $25 million, $100 million, or $1 billion to implement those, Rod. People that have over $1 million, I would say at least, probably closer to two, those are the people that I think are a great fit to be exposed to some of these things like institutional bond buying. Don't buy from the place where the source is. Don't buy from the desk. Because if you're out there buying, you know, out of someone's inventory, that has already been passed up by the institutional people. They don't want it. That's why it's out there. One of our guys that runs our institutional fixed income said any bond in inventory of any of these big firms aren't any good. He said no one wanted them at the institutional level. Making money on their money, you mentioned that. Using risk management tools to reduce risk overall. So, Rod, I guess get your opinion on this, but when someone has at least $1 million, certainly at $2 million, these opportunities now start to pop their head open for those, or pop their head up for these folks.
Yeah, most certainly, because now you're starting to have enough dollars that you meet minimum qualifications for some of these private type of investments, private placements that have certain criteria that you have to meet to even be approved to invest in them. You had mentioned the risk management side of things. You know, that's another area that I think that the high net worth person does a good job. Your example of them parking a lot of money in tax-free bonds. Well, part of the reason that they would do that is maybe they're a small business owner of a business that's not publicly traded. So it's large for a small business. You know, maybe they're doing 75 or 100 million in revenue a year, but they're not publicly traded. There isn't a stock out there. Well, they have a lot of risk with the management of their business and the cash flow and whatever the product or service that they're selling. That brings on risk. So why add risk to that? You know, so they do a very appropriate job of managing the risk. They also know and understand risk, and I think that is an area that you as an advisor on the front line and our other advisors in our office on the front line, that's something you guys have to attempt to do. We all know and feel very comfortable. We leave money in the market 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, that it's going to be worth more than it was when we first put that money into the market. Not all of our clientele feel that comfortable about the market. You know, and if they get involved and see a 10, 15, 20% correction fairly soon after they got in, they begin thinking, well, gosh, if I can lose 20% in 3 months, it's only a matter of time before I lose everything. You know, we know that if you're buying large, well-established, blue-chip type companies, they're not all going to zero. You know, that's not the case. But the retail investor doesn't necessarily feel that comfort level and fully understand the risks that they're taking with different asset classes, with their income in itself, because that has to be incorporated into that risk analogy and where you can best invest. And I think some of those higher net worth people, because part of it is to get to that higher net worth, as you're talking about, not just a good saver who is a blue-collar millionaire and ended up with $1 million or $1.5 million in his 401k, but the people who really accumulated wealth either by building a business or starting their investment program at a very, very young age and just kept compounding those returns over and over for multiple decades and end up with a huge nest egg at the end of it. Well, they evaluated risk all along the way. They did their best to study and understand it. And if it wasn't in an area of their expertise, they had conversations with people who had a better understanding so they could really analyze where it's at. Does that mean those high net worth people never pick bad investments? No, they most certainly do. You know, nobody bats 1,000 in the investing world, but they feel more comfortable from the standpoint of expectations and what they expect should happen and what kind of volatility is around and what's the time horizon that they should expect to have to hold this type of an investment and get to even or profitability, because obviously the game and objective isn't to just get to even, it's to actually make some money on that. And I think that goes a long way is their comfort level of taking on risk and under and understanding that risk and what it really means, even if the product isn't something that they know forwards and backwards and they lean on an advisor to understand the product, they understand the risk component of that product and what they're taking on and the impact it could have on their financial situation today and in the future.
Yeah, when you have a major economic turndown and you're in the construction business, you don't want the money that you had saved up also in a economic downturn. You want that powder to be fresh. So I always say, refer to the Moshe Milevsky, are you a stock or are you a bond philosophy? And that means if you're a business owner, you are a stock. Should you then turn around and re-risk your money in other things? It's up to you, but I would take the opinion you should be more conservative. Now, in the Wall Street Journal, on that older Americans invest like 30-year-olds, it said many changes in the past half century have contributed to older Americans' reliance on stocks, including the 1978 tax law change that ushered in the old 401k plan and started to get rid of pension plans, and several decades where stocks have beat bonds. That's the mindset. So you have this recency bias during the and you have this mentality during the financial or economic crisis, including 87, 01, 08, and even 2020, guess what happened? The Federal Reserve or Congress stepped in to save the day. So people have this attitude that don't worry, even if things go down, they're always going to come back up and they'll set new highs. That came from Robert Shiller, of course, a Nobel-winning prize economist at Yale. And the other thing, since 1982, the S&P has returned 10.1% a year on average. That's significantly more than the index's long-term average of 7.4% since 1982. So, as a beneficiary of high stock market returns, baby boomers tend to report a greater willingness to take financial risks than those that lived through, obviously, like the Great Depression. It's what we've lived through most recently and have personally experienced that wires our brain economically, but sometimes that brain needs to be rewired, and you need to understand how people with money have money, how they get money, and how do they keep their money. Rod, I appreciate you as always. If you've got anything else going on, you can throw it in now. Otherwise, I'll let you go, and I'll see you back at the ranch.
No, Dave, I think you hit on it all. It's just very important for people to educate themselves, not to be an expert, because you can lean on the expert, but you want to have some knowledge and understanding of the risk categories, how it incorporates into your financial situation, which includes your job, that paycheck that you're collecting, where you're trying to get to, and what that time horizon is. And if you have a better feel for that, like I said, you don't need to be an expert, but if you have a better understanding of all of those versus just saying, you're the expert, you do it, I don't know or understand this, I think you'll feel a lot more comfortable with some of the gyrations and fluctuations that happen in the market that we can't control in the short run. But the longer time that you're exposed to the market, the more predictable it becomes.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I might dive in a little bit more to the institutional buying of fixed income so people understand that just a little bit more if I have time. But I'll be back at Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Thanks again for hanging out with me. I really appreciate it. I love the opportunity to be here with all of you and hopefully bring you some thoughtful, insightful, sometimes inspiring things to motivate you to move or to think or do something, right? Maybe it's to have a fireworks show. Anything to get you fired up and excited. So I do have a little bit of time. I'll talk about this. So basically, let me just kind of walk you through this. When you buy a stock, there is a bid and ask price. Okay, there's a price that you buy it for and a price you can sell it for. And that's always, you're going to always buy it for more than what you can sell it for in that moment. And that's a little spread. And that spread kind of is a little wider for some and a little tighter for others. If I call one fund manager and say, hey, I'd like to take that $100 million of XYZ company off your hands, then they're going to get a little better deal than if you just go on to your trading platform, wherever you trade, and buy that stock. So that's the difference between institutional and retail. The difference on bonds is even larger. So a bond originates off of an institutional desk. They'll either create the bond and sell it to customers like insurance companies, some mutual funds, and then also financial institutions. So they'll have a bond, and they might say, hey, it's yielding 6%, matures in 10 years, And it's this particular bond. And it may be something you've never even heard of before. Credit rating might be really good. Who knows? It may have a defeasance option to it, which means they're putting money back to pay it at maturity. You know, it's institutional stuff. And that money, net bond, usually never makes it to where you could buy it. And even most advisors don't have access to it because you aren't trading institutionally. So your firm that you deal with may buy this institutional bond from the institutional world. Then they take it, and like a car dealership, they mark it up and they throw it in their inventory. Then your advisor, and this is almost in every case, unless you're dealing with someone who deals with higher net worth people, they then go into their inventory to buy the bond for you. And if it's in a transactional type of relationship, they have to mark it up, a commission, maybe 2 points, and then they sell it to you. And then you own it. And you're like, okay, I own this bond. It pays this interest rate. That's what I paid for it. And you're cool with it because you don't even know that the institutional trade happened. The institution marks it up. Then it got marked up again before it ever landed in your lap. Or it's not marked up for a commission, but it's still marked up by the institution. And then the person who buys it for you or is kind of monitoring it are charging you a fee. So either way, you're not getting the best price. And to be honest, that most bonds that you see on a retail desk aren't bonds that any institution wanted. Otherwise, they would own them because they own the best stuff. So if you can somehow align yourself with an institutional buyer, and most of the big mutual funds, they're institutional buyers, don't get me wrong, but they charge you a management fee, right, to buy it, and you don't have any control. People with money don't go out and buy XYZ bond fund because they have no control. They don't know when the maturity dates are. They don't know what their interest rate is. They want to own the actual bond. So that is a big, big difference. And the other thing about a mutual fund is there's no maturity date. It's perpetual, right? So if rates start to go up, you're going to lose value no matter what. And you just have to sit on your hands and not do anything about it. But if you own a bond that you own and you plan to hold to maturity and rates spike and your values go down if you decided to sell it, you know what? Who cares? Just keep collecting what you were collecting, kind of wait it out a little bit, and it will contractually come back. What better situation to be in than that? So anyway, that's just a little bit of a difference between retail and institutional. And again, when should you start to think about inquiring about institutional stuff? I would say once you've threshold over maybe $1.5 million, certainly at $2 million, then you should have access to these things that other people simply don't have access to, and it will allow you to quit investing like a poor person. That's kind of funny, right? All right, we'll take a break, come back, and wrap up the show. It's Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Hey, we just got a few minutes left in today's program. Of course, if you miss it on Thursday night, Saturday mornings at 9, always on WGCLradio.com and where you catch your favorite podcasts as well. So, you know, I say things sometimes, and I'm joking, but I'm really not joking. I mean, at some point you have to wake up and say, hey, there may be a different way. And, you know, if you want to have a discussion about what that really means, feel free to reach out to us. I'll be happy to have a conversation with you or one of the other guys. Just explain what that really means. How do we always have our money making money? How do we invest institutionally? How do we make sure we have proper risk management tools in place? What does that all mean? So hopefully we did a decent job of kind of describing that. And the other piece of advice I give people is quit taking advice from people that are broke, right? You take advice from people at work, and the reality of it is some of them are pretty darn smart and pretty good and probably do great, but the majority of people, they're no different than most people. You know, they're just trying to do what they need to do to get to the end of the road here. And the other thing I've been talking a lot about with people, going back to the just-in-case retirement, right? Don't forget, don't save and save and save and then die. You want to enjoy life along the way. Enjoy your family, enjoy your friends, and just look forward to a great life and a great retirement. If you do that, man, everything works out great. But certainly live along the way. It's good advice. Don't take financial advice from broke people. Quit investing like you're poor when you're not, and the world will be much, much rosier. So listen, guys, I'll miss you next week, but we will have a great replay, I promise. And I'll be back in 2 weeks to man, I can't believe it'll be like towards the 18th when I get back. So it'll be the 20th when I'm back, July 20th. Jeez, man, time goes fast when you're having fun. I'll talk to you all then. Take care. Bye-bye.
The preceding program was brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities.